Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Mark Quitz. We're your hosts as always on this weekend's edition and throughout the week for our daily editorials and company updates on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Look, I realize that all eyes are on the Fed coming up next week on Wednesday with their statement and press conference. Pretty much a 50 basis point rate hike baked in for at least that meeting and the one following. A lot of people are looking 3+ hikes out or meetings out to see what that guidance is. I feel like we've talked about that all the time on our daily editorials. So we're going to switch focus a little bit to kick off this weekend show. We are chatting with Jayant Bhandari, private investor as well as consultant to a lot of the well-known investors in the resource sector. Now, Jayant, you're well known on our site and in the industry as being one that really dives into some of the junior resource stocks, also making your way up to the mid caps. What we're going to talk about here is jurisdictions. We're going to start with the Golden Triangle, but we're going to move throughout Canada, throughout the U.S., and some other jurisdictions around the world. I want to start in Canada because the Golden Triangle, I think every resource investor knows about the Golden Triangle. And I think a lot of resource investors know that the Golden Triangle companies, they have a very short work program year when they can get on site. Usually we see these stocks running before the drilling starts, which usually happens in midsummer. This year, because of how tough the market is, these stocks are not running, unfortunately. But let me ask you then, Jayant, how are you viewing the Golden Triangle as a jurisdictional play for resource investors?
Hi, Corey. Thanks for having me. So I have one company that I'm invested in the Golden Triangle area. I usually shy away from Golden Triangle. The reason is that virtually every company that I come across in Golden Triangle, from my perspective, is overpriced. There is the sexiness associated with Golden Triangle, the apparent high grade that some of these companies have. But at the end of the day, the market's expectations are too high. The market does not necessarily understand how rugged that area is, how difficult the infrastructural situation in that area is, and how difficult it is to drill and mine in that area. So you can look at some of the companies that are well known in that area and just look at their balance sheets, and you might realize that their market capitalization might be lower than all the money that they have ever raised, which means that if you add up all the investors that they have ever had, an average investor lost value investing in that area, which does not mean that I have anything against specific companies. As I said, I am invested in one Golden Triangle company, but at a huge loss right now. But you have to be careful not to invest based on the sexiness associated with Golden Triangle.
Well, Jayant, this is just more of a general question before we dive into some of the other jurisdictions. That is, when there is a seasonal area due to weather patterns like the Golden Triangle, but there's other areas that are like that. Some areas have rainy seasons. Some areas, have to have the ice to be able to drill over swampy areas. Other areas, there's not enough water, so they have issues with, getting people in. How does that affect? Do you play any of the seasonality where you try to get into something like a Golden Triangle while it's the hot drill assay release season and then get back out of it? Or is there any other areas where you look at weather-related situations?
Yes and no, Shad. I mean, given that prices of Golden Triangle companies have fallen so much, I should actually be looking at some of those companies right now. All I have to do is to imagine what would happen next year at the same time. Maybe they would be drilling next year at this time. So if those stocks have fallen by 50 or 70% just because of the fact that they are likely not drilling this year, they have fallen far too much for what delay means in terms of loss of value. So I would only discount what I would have expected as the value by 20% for a one-year delay. And if prices have fallen more than that, then I'm actually should be looking at those companies and investing in them.
So, Giant, let's also talk about another high-cost jurisdiction that's up further north. It can be northern Canada, also northern U.S. in Alaska. Do you have any preference in terms of if you're looking even further north in North America, a jurisdiction that you like up there out of those even higher-cost operator areas?
Let's look at Yukon, a jurisdiction that I have been to several times. In the Northwestern Territories, there was a tungsten mine. I have been there, and they look very high-grade projects. The problem in Yukon area is that the cost of production and the cost of building infrastructure can be extremely high. So you can look at a couple of companies that are producing in Yukon, and you realize that it's very hard to make money in Yukon. Infrastructure is very difficult, and it's a very, very cold environment most of the year in Yukon. On top of all this, Yukon has something called a water body. I don't remember the formal name of that body, but that body is independent of the government, and they basically decide whether a mining project goes ahead or not. And that's an extremely conservative body. So you have to be very careful about whether they will ever give permission for a mining project to go ahead. So, we were offline talking about one project that is going to entail a massive tailing facility in Yukon. And I think that project will stay a dream unless they completely re-engineer the project with some higher grade material, because the water body is not going to let that tailings dam come to exist. That tailings dam, from what I recall, will be the size of one large city. So that's going to be a massive pond that will get created, and they will not allow that to happen. The water body in Yukon.
Yeah, Giant, that's a great point. There's a lot of things that look good on paper, but practically they oftentimes are not going to get built or are going to have social pushback or pushback from the permitting side of things. So always important to consider. Corey had kind of thrown in Alaska with that last question. I may just ask you specifically about it. We've seen two major projects get blocked in Alaska just in the last 2 years. The Pebble project that Northern Dynasty holds, and now more recently the Trilogy copper project. So while Alaska has a lot of interesting mines, and including Fort Knox, and it has a lot of interesting mining history, it seems like it's getting harder and harder to get projects built and approved there. What is your take on Alaska?
Well, I think Alaska tends to be a good jurisdiction, but you have to have a project that is easy to permit, or at least not be a project that is impossible to permit. I think historically, a company like Northern Dynasty has been sold on the basis of the massive amount of copper and gold it has in the ground. But the problem is, it is a low-grade project. So even if the permit had been granted, is it a project that is financially viable is a big question. Now, I know that the company that they had a joint venture with, I've been to the project a couple of times, they spent, I think, close to $600 million or $1 billion on that project, drilling it, doing all the design work on the project. But at the end of the day, some of these projects are just not financially viable, but people just keep throwing money at some of these projects in expectation of commodity prices going to the sky. And I think that is often an erroneous way to invest in some of these projects. Alaska, again, is a good jurisdiction in my view, but you have to be concerned. You have to take into account that some of the infrastructure that you want to lay down might not be possible because of First Nations opposition or because of just lack of economics that some of these projects might have.
Yeah, when you consider just how much money has been spent on some of these projects up north and the lack of, I guess, actual mining that we have up there, I'm sure it is a bit disappointing for some investors. There has been, some of these projects simply turn into a money pit. Let's also talk about Newfoundland, because Newfoundland, still on a lot of investors' minds, really came in as an area play a couple years ago with newfound gold hitting some very impressive grades and a complete land rush by a lot of juniors into Newfoundland. We haven't seen really too many majors get into the country or get into that province. How are you viewing Newfoundland as a play for investors interested in exploration?
I have nothing against the jurisdiction, but again, whenever there is too much of excitement about a jurisdiction, I tend to shy away just because prices tend to get overpriced. And that's exactly when I want to sell and walk away after booking my profit. Now, I have mentioned in the past a company called Maritime Resources. I am invested in that. I'm invested in what is now known as Signal Mining, which is used to be Anaconda Mining. I think both good companies, particularly Maritime Resources, which I think offers a fabulous value, except that, of course, they are probably running out of money. So I would not necessarily buy too much of it right now. Again, I have nothing against the jurisdiction. I think some of these companies make a lot of sense to me. But when there is too much of euphoria about a jurisdiction, a lot of people who have nothing to show will stake in area without any reason to get investor invest and make money from it. But I don't want to be invested in such companies.
That's a solid point, Giant. I think a lot of these companies in an area play when an area gets hot because of a discovery, a lot of people just start staking land and they're more mining the investor base than they are mining the ground. So that
absolutely
just tends to happen
on
any area play. But let's talk about another hot one in Canada. And it's been a good jurisdiction for a long time, and that's Red Lake. You have the big Red Lake mine that was run by Goldcorp, now Evolution Mining. You've got Pure Gold that went into productions, had a few speed bumps, the epic Great Bear takeout last year by Kinross. But there's probably a dozen, almost two dozen other companies all vying for position in Red Lake. What do you make of that jurisdiction?
Well, excellent place to operate in. Again, you have to remember that it's a tough jurisdiction. If you recall, I used to be on the board of a company called Gold Canyon, which had this Spring Pole project. It's a tough area, but if you have economics right, then I don't see a problem in investing in that area. Now, Pure Gold ran into problems. I mean, Matson project was never an easy project. If market thought it was going to be easy, it was the misunderstanding of the market. So I think what people really have to remember is that they are not investing in the area. They are investing in a specific project, and that project must make economic sense after taking into account the infrastructure required and the time delay required in getting permitted.
So, Giant, let's talk about the U.S. then, okay? Because the U.S., lots of different jurisdictions that we can touch on here. Let's start with probably the best-known jurisdiction, Nevada. Man, there are a lot of companies active in Nevada, both majors and juniors, and a lot of mines that make money there. There's also a lot of low-grade gold that companies find and build up resources around. What entices you about Nevada? What do you avoid in Nevada? How do you invest in Nevada?
Well, I think I'm very simple about my investment methodology anyway, which is a simple discounted cash flow valuation of these companies. And Nevada as a jurisdiction gives me peace of mind. There are delays about permitting everywhere on the planet, but at least you have a defined structure on how to get permitted. It's a relatively safe jurisdiction. It is a jurisdiction where you can find competencies in terms of miners and geologists, and people understand that area. So it's a good state to operate in. Now, that does not mean I would invest in projects that that are low grade and which don't make economic sense to me. If you recall, there was this multi-billion-dollar company which actually went bankrupt trying to mine a lot of ounces at a lot of losses, which meant that the more they produced, the faster they went bankrupt. So, you know, you can invest just based on a very speculative expectation of the future of some of those projects. But basically, one should avoid investing in low-grade projects, particularly low-grade projects that are uneconomic from any financial point of view. Some of the low-grade projects, particularly which are oxidized rock, can actually make you a lot of money. So that's perfectly fine. But people have to pay attention to the economics, even when they invest in jurisdictions that are good.
Yeah, a lot of times people just hear the word Nevada and assume it's a slam dunk, but not every project is a slam dunk. And you have to differentiate the different kinds of ore too. If it's got refractory ore, can they process it? If it's got sulfides, do they have the ability to get a mill built or a mill nearby? Lots to consider besides just the state it's in. But Nevada is probably the hands down best jurisdiction in the United States. One of the other ones that's top of the list in the US is Idaho. A lot of silver mining in the Silver Valley. A whole peppering of, a couple dozen companies up there. What's your take on Idaho?
There is one company that I quite like in Idaho, Revival Gold. And I think they have a decent project with a decent future. But also remember, that area has a lot of legacy issues. So you have to be careful about which company you are investing in Idaho and the province next to it. They have historically been a lot of silver mining in that area. And there is an environmental legacy issues associated with acquiring that project. And most people don't remember, keep that in mind, that once these companies have acquired those projects, they become responsible for the environmental issues that come to their books because of the past. I would be very careful about which company I'm investing in. I want to explore the history of those projects and what kind of environmental legacies associated with those projects. But otherwise, I have nothing against the jurisdiction.
So, Giant, what other areas in the U.S. do you like? Which other ones do you avoid? We could talk California that seems to constantly have permitting issues. We could talk Arizona, where there are a number of exploration and large companies in that state. A number of other states that we could talk about. Wyoming, there are companies active in. What do you like? What do you dislike in terms of the rest of the U.S.?
Well, I think you have pretty much explained what I like and don't like about the US. Nevada is a great jurisdiction. Arizona is perfectly fine. California is a complete disaster. I can't remember if I have ever come across a project that made money in California. They, even if they went into production, they could not make money in trying to meet the constant demands of the environmental bodies. And once you don't have many mining projects in a state, then the government bodies, regulatory bodies also become very conservative because they don't really know what they are up to. And this is exactly the same problem with Yukon as well. Yukon has a massive, from what I recall, a massive department dedicated for mining purposes. But if they don't really have too many mines, they have a couple of mines right now, they will become conservative because they don't really have the daily experience of permitting projects and checking on those projects. So I think Nevada and Arizona are good jurisdictions. That's where I would go for.
Well, Giant, let's round out the rest of North America and actually the bridge into Latin America with a huge mining country, and that is Mexico. I realize there's lots of different states and they kind of all drill down to more of a local level. But when you think about investing in Mexico, are there any takeaways that you would leave for investors, some do's and some don'ts?
Mexico is a country I became pessimistic about when the new president came into power. But I don't see things to have taken too bad a turn after he came into power. So I am perfectly fine with Mexico the way it stands right now. I am investing in Mexico. I go to Mexico quite often as well these days, and I am happy with the jurisdiction. Now, remember, Latin America as an area is going downhill across the board. But I'm here as an investor, and I'm here for the next 5 to 10 years at most. So from that perspective, a lot of companies that I'm invested in Mexico look perfectly fine to me, and I'm a happy investor. However, having said that, apart from Mexico, I think the rest of Latin America is on a completely wrong path, and one has to become increasingly worried about what is happening in the rest of Latin America.
So, Giant, can you share some of your favorite stocks then, either in Mexico or in some of the other jurisdictions we touched on that you are positive on?
So there's one company called Aztec Minerals. They closed their financing yesterday, I think. The ticker is AZT. It is trading at 28 cents, and I gave them more money at 30 cents in the latest financing. So I retained my original ownership in Aztec, which was a lot of money that I gave them in the first round at 30 cent. And I did the second round as well at 30 cent. So that's one of my very favorite companies. I mentioned to you about maritime resources. There's a company called Harfang Exploration. The ticker is HAR, a company that I mentioned to you in the past. That is in Quebec, and they are trading at about 30 cents. And I think that's a company that people should look at. The funny thing is that this company rolled back its stock 1-for-2 shares or 1.2.55 share, but the share price continued to be the same, which means that probably some people forgot that the company has rolled back 2.55 to 1. So I think, and they are well cashed up company. They have $10-12 million in cash. So it's a company to look at.
All right, Giant. Really appreciate your insights on it. Really was just North American down to Mexico. This is going to be part of an ongoing series, though. Next time we have you on, we'll dive a bit more into some of the South American countries and then even look to Africa, Australia. There's a lot of other jurisdictions we can talk, but we really did just want to dive into some of the more well-known ones around where a lot of our listeners are, and that is around North America. If anybody wants us to talk more specifically about some of these other jurisdictions, feel free to email us, because as I mentioned, when we have Giant on next, we'll talk some of these other jurisdictions. Giant, thank you so much for taking time on this weekend show. We'll chat again soon. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Great. Thanks very much for the opportunity.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Giant Bhandari, as we did take a little bit of a different tack to focus on a lot of the more well-known jurisdictions in and around North America. I know there are a lot of other jurisdictions for us to talk about, so as we mentioned, we will be focusing a bit more on some of those other jurisdictions in future conversations with Giant. In this segment, we are chatting with Jeffrey Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. We're going to continue to focus on commodities, resources, and precious metals. But first things first here, Jeff, big picture, it seems like these markets, while we are entering summer, are in a state where most commentators, most investors are quite bored with the narrative out there. We had the war in Ukraine, which is still going on. That moved markets earlier on this year, but now seemingly the markets seem to be more or less ignoring any of the headlines out of Ukraine, except for the fact that oil continues to remain quite elevated. But that's not only just Ukraine that's causing that. And everybody's focusing on inflation, which we had some data out on Friday. Again, inflation remaining high. That's not really changing. Fed policy, it looks like the Fed is going to continue to hike rates. Now the market's even pricing in a 50 basis point hike, 3 meetings out in September. That's the new development from this week. But again, overall, things seem relatively boring and relatively consistent with what the markets are dealing with. Jeff, how do you view this environment where, again, it seems like summer is going to be slow and could continue to have some pressure on the markets?
Yeah, it's a very interesting time. I mean, if you just, in the first quarter, silver was the best performing asset class. You know, it went from the beginning of the first quarter to the end of the first quarter, it was up like 7.6%. Gold was up 6.6%. The next best performing asset class in the 11 that we measure was cash at 0.6%. And everything else, stocks and bonds and real estate, were off negative 2% to negative 8%. You know, that was the first quarter. Second quarter, you've had the, and the factors there were inflation fears and then expectations of rising interest rates, and then the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In the second quarter, the Fed was raising interest rates much more forcefully than a lot of people had expected, including themselves. Inflation, there was big question marks about the trends in inflation, and the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which they thought would take 6 days, bogged down. And to use the right metaphor, I think, you know, right now, as we approach the end of the second quarter and into the third quarter, we're in the trenches, you know, and we've got missiles flying over us. You know, there are inflation concerns, and with the higher oil prices that we're seeing now and that we are expecting to see over the next 3 months or so, you know, that's going to keep inflation higher than a lot of people had thought. Interest rates, as you said, you know, they'll raise them 50 bips at the next two meetings each. And then there's this big question mark about, you know, what are they going to do in September? And, you know, the CME has this FedWatch tool, and it shows us that the market has a 60% probability. The market thinks there's a 60% probability of another 50 basis point increase in September. But that is entirely dependent on what happens in the economy, both in the United States and on a global basis, between now and September, which is going to be a long 3 or 4 months, and a very hot 3 or 4 months, compounded by the fact that you've got the U.S. midterm elections going on and a variety of other political and social issues that will compound it. So, yeah, we're in the trenches. It may look boring, but the data that's coming out, you know, and every day you get data that either says inflation's a problem or interest rates are going to have a good effect, and they can raise interest rates without throwing us into a recession, or, you know, no, the inflationary pressures are greater. You're going to see this conflicting data coming back and forth, and market sentiments will be there. And we're probably in this Sargasso Sea of, you know, gold between 1800 and 1880, and silver between $21 and $25 for the next several months.
Yeah, Jeff, there's no shortage of missiles data flying over our heads as we're in the trenches. And it does seem like everybody is waiting to see how some of this resolves itself. On the topic of inflation, there is a lot of conflicting data and conflicting points of view out there. But I think what's interesting is the dichotomy now between the actual data itself, which has actually mildly started coming down on the CPI readings, versus the inflation expectations, which a year ago, nobody was worried about inflation. They did believe it was transitory, and the expectations were very low. Fast forward to today, and everybody's expectations of inflation are much higher now that it actually may temper and start heading down. So how do you square that book as far as the inflation metrics actually starting to gradually trend down versus the expectations being up so much in the market?
We have been saying for some time that we thought that, you know, just from a simple arithmetic perspective, you'd start seeing lower increases, you know, smaller percentage changes in price levels in the second and third quarters of this year. And you're going to see that. And if we had thought about it, probably we should be talking tomorrow afternoon after the CPI comes out. But I do think that you'll see food prices and energy prices staying high because there are extenuating circumstances, you know, including the war between Russia and Ukraine that are going to compound that. But I do think that you'll also see some signs of lower increases or smaller increases in prices of other things as the economy continues to move through the expansion phase toward late expansion phase, you know. So I think that our expectation is that we will see the inflation figures coming off and some of the inflation expectations probably cooling off as well. And we're already starting to see people who had been talking about inflation being really problematic. Some of them are starting to back away from that and saying, okay, well, maybe inflation won't be quite that problematic, et cetera, et cetera. There are still inflation hawks out there, especially in the gold and silver markets. But I do think that some of the people are starting to hedge their bets.
Jeff, do you see the upcoming U.S. midterm elections playing a role at all in the markets, in what the Fed does, in really anything to disrupt, again, this kind of boring time that we're in?
Yeah, I think the midterm elections themselves, they'll have some impact on it. But I think the political and social arguments surrounding the midterm election will have a more prominent effect on gold and silver markets, because they're creating this environment where there are a lot of people who are very seriously concerned about the state of the U.S. society, as well as the political system. And, you know, there's a growing realization, which I can't believe that anybody never believed this, but there's a growing amount of people who are saying, yeah, you know, the political system is broken. It's dysfunctional. It's not helping anyone. And, you know, you do have some moderate politicians, but their voices are being drowned out by these two extremes on either side. And nothing's getting done. I do think it'll be a problem. It'll be an issue. And it's, you know, investors are going to look at it and say, I should probably have some gold.
Well, Jeff, we hear the narrative that the Fed is going to be subservient to these political wills to not let the markets crash. Do you think they're really too focused on the markets, or are they more focused on the economy and the health of the economy and the labor markets? Because we hear all these different narratives. Where do you think the Fed is really focused when they're making their policy decisions?
I think the Fed focuses exclusively on the economy. And I think the narrative that the Fed looks at the stock market and says, oh, we have to do policy based on the stock market and keeping it up, is a straw man that doesn't really exist. You know, I think the Fed is wholly focused on its regulated objectives of trying to balance, you know, maximum employment and minimum prices. And I think that that's entirely what they look at.
In all fairness, though, Jeff, it seems like the Fed has switched course when we have seen a market meltdown. Are you just saying that that has happened hand in hand with U.S. economic weakness, and that's why the Fed has shifted?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you go back to like 2015, 2016, when they started to tighten, do some quantitative tightening, and they basically sucked too much money out of the system too fast, and all of a sudden you had payments problems in the banking system. Those payment problems were reflected in volatile and weak equity markets. But I think the Fed was reacting to the fact that its financial or its monetary policies had caused liquidity issues and a liquidity mismatch in the currency market and in the money market. And I think that they were reacting to that. And the stock market was reacting to that plus its expectations of what the Fed would do.
Well, Jeff, we also hear that the Fed will eventually, let's say we get out the next two or three meetings, we get the 50 basis point hikes in June and July, and possibly another 25 or 50 basis point hike in September. But at that point, many market watchers are looking for the Fed to reverse course and or at least pause. And many people think that's what's going to give gold a big boost. Do you share that same philosophy?
I think the Fed will probably be inclined. Again, it's entirely dependent on what the economic data is at the time in September and October going into the November midterm election and such. You know, the Fed has tended to try to not make major changes in interest rates in advance of elections ever since they raised interest rates in 1992. And George H. Bush, you know, blamed Greenspan for costing him the election, you know, to which everybody said, no, George, it's you. I think the Fed will be inclined to pause in raising interest rates after August, but maybe, you know, maybe after September. I think they'll be inclined to take a pause and see how things unfold. I do expect that the CPI figures will be coming in lower growth, lower increases in inflation, which will give them the cover to pause. I don't know that they're going to reverse field and lower interest rates unless you get into a liquidity crisis the way we did in 2015, 2016, whenever that was. So I don't think that that's an accurate assessment of how the Fed behaves necessarily. But one of the things that the Fed does, you know, it's interesting because we're in a situation really over the last 35, 40 years where the Fed basically increases interest rates after FOMC meetings. But the Fed has the discretion to raise and lower interest rates at any time. And prior to, say, the early to mid-1980s, it would do that whenever it felt like it needed to. So it does have the discretion to come in between FOMC meetings and say, okay, there's something happening here, and we either need to raise or lower interest rates now and not wait for the next FOMC meeting. So, you know, I think that the nuanced power that the Fed has is lost in a lot of the public commentary about monetary policy.
All right, Jeff, let's move on from the Fed and generally just these boring markets and these markets that continue to get pressured on the downside to talk about silver, because you just hosted a Silver Facts and Fantasies, the second iteration of this webinar on Thursday, June 9th. Now, I think that the replay will be available for everybody to check that out, but let's dive into silver, because out of the precious metals, silver has been one of the more disappointing ones, especially when you compare it to gold. Just recently, silver is, well, trending lower and also threatening to break lower. It was the beginning of May that silver had one of its worst weekly closes in almost 2 years, I think over 2 years. What's your outlook for silver, and why has it consistently been pressured more so than gold?
Well, I think a couple of things. I mean, our outlook is we wouldn't be surprised to see the price of silver go back lower and test 20. I think it stays above 20 because there are a lot of factors that are positive for silver and stimulative of silver. But, you know, we're looking at 20 to 25 for the next month or so. We're looking at 20 to 28 for the next 3 or 4 months as what we think are reasonably probable ranges for the silver price. Silver has weakened for a variety of reasons. You've definitely seen disenchanted investors pulling back from the silver market. There are a lot of people who drank the Kool-Aid or at least snorted the powder last year, and they were convinced that the price was going to $30 or $50 or $700, and it didn't happen. And I think that there are a lot of investors who feel like they've been had, and they've backed away. In addition to that, you have blank manufacturing constraints still restraining the supply of silver eagles and other silver bullion coins that a lot of smaller investors want. And that has led to very high premia for the silver bullion coins, and that has further reduced investor demand for silver. I think that those things are probably relatively temporary types of things, and hopefully we can get beyond them over the next, 5 or 6 months so that 2023 looks like a different year. But, you know, I think that those are probably the major two reasons why silver has underperformed. The third thing, I got to point this out. In the first quarter, we have a table. We look at 9 asset classes, large cap U.S., small cap U.S., real estate, cash, U.S. treasuries, non-U.S. treasury bonds. We have like 9 different asset classes plus gold and silver. And in the first quarter, looking at just like the beginning of the quarter to the end of the quarter, silver was the best performer of those 11 asset classes at 7.6% increase. Gold was the second best at 6.6. The third best was cash at 0.6. And everything else, all of the other financial assets, stocks and bonds and real estate, were -2 to -7.5%. So one of the reasons why silver has underperformed in the second quarter is that it overperformed relative to everything else in the first quarter. So a little bit of perspective and a little bit less greed, helps the investor keep his assets in his possession as opposed to in somebody else's possession.
I think that's a really good point, Jeff. And sometimes it's easy for people to get swept into the bearish narrative, but they're not really looking at it in context of other asset classes. And when you look at the big picture, silver did pretty good in the first quarter, maybe a little weaker in the second quarter, but it didn't fall out of bed, and neither did gold. I was interested in this panel that you just did at the Vancouver Resource Investor Conference, where you were on the stage with Rick Rule, Jim Lewis from Wall Street Silver, and Jose Garcia from Silver X Mining, and Jay Martin was hosting it. And you guys discussed the silver market, and you talked about a lot of the supply and demand side. And you mentioned that you still really look at the investment side of the equation. And I also thought you made an interesting point, Jeff, where you mentioned that a lot of the new investors that everybody were excited about in the silver squeeze movement that they thought were coming to the table, that actually on the investment demand side, a lot of the biggest investment demand came way before that in 2020, and the numbers weren't as big in 2021. And that kind of dispels that notion. So are there any other of the fantasies from these facts and fantasies part of the silver equation that you think would be interesting to highlight for investors, just to point out perception versus reality?
Yeah, let me run through a few of them. You know, I thought one of the nicest or most interesting points was, you know, Rick Rule had congratulated Jim Lewis. Jim Lewis was very proud of the fact that he had like 200,000 followers on Reddit or Twitter or someplace. And Rick, you know, congratulated him on bringing 200,000 new investors to silver. And, you know, Jim said, well, these guys may not be new investors to silver because the demographics suggest they may have been around for a while. But I made the point, these are not necessarily investors in silver at all. These are 200,000 people who have signed up to get free bitsies of information on the internet, you know. And as you said, you know, if you look at the price of silver was moribund, really below $16 for several years from like 2014 until June of 2020. And then in July of 2020, silver broke out of this narrow range of like $12 to $16. And it went from $16 to $20 to $25 to $30 all in the course of June. You know, by the first week of August, it peaked over at $30 or a little over $30. And then it came off. And that was all prior to the Wall Street silver thing. You know, so my point is, he might have 200,000 people who want to listen to his commentary, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there are 200,000 people investing in silver. Because if I know anything from selling silver research for the last 40 years, the Venn diagram of people who buy silver research and people who buy silver, there is an overlap, but it's not that big. But going on to the facts and fantasies, let me just run through a few of them that I made in the thing this morning. Silver prices are high, even at $21 as we're speaking, or actually $21.80 as we're speaking. Silver prices are high. They were, as I said, stuck below $16 for about 5 years until the middle of 2020. Silver prices are actually at pretty high levels. So that's the first thing. Second thing is the world's not running out of silver. There's plenty of mineable reserves. There's twice as much mineable reserves today as there was in 1988. Even though we've mined 20 billion ounces of silver in the intervening, you know, four decades. So there's plenty of silver there. There's plenty of silver above ground. There's plenty of silver in the COMEX depositories, Shanghai, London, and in unreported inventories around the world. Solar panels are helping. You know, that's growing as a use. It's taking more silver and using it and tying up in solar panels that have useful lives of, you know, 10 or 15 years. So that is helping drive fabrication demand higher. And fabrication demand is struggling to get back to its pre-pandemic levels. Problems in the auto industry, which uses a fair amount of silver, and other applications are limiting the growth rate of silver, but it is growing. And solar is doing well and will continue to do well. So I think those are some of the things, you know, I tried to pivot the focus in today's talk. And instead of saying facts and fantasies, I said silver truths. And let's talk about the truths, that silver prices are high. There's plenty of silver around. Investors continue to buy silver. Fabricators continue to use it. And, you know, the production cost, the average cash cost of silver producers, about $8.50 last year. That's the cash cost, not the full in cost. Silver is a profitable industry to be in.
So, Jeff, what do you think it's going to take to get maybe a younger demographic into the precious metals, investing in the precious metals? We've heard plenty of times that once Bitcoin or the cryptocurrency sector crashes, then we're going to see that rotation of the younger generation into the precious metals. But in all fairness, we've seen a number of large pullbacks in the cryptocurrency space, and I still see a lot of the younger generation preferring cryptos vastly more than precious metals. Is there any hope for the precious metals investors that the younger demographic, those that are making more money right now, will actually come into the sector?
Well, a couple of points. First off, I don't think we've seen the crash of cryptos. You know, I mean, if you look at the tech stock boom and bust the late 90s into 2001 as a model for what's going to happen to crypto. You're looking at an across the board 86% or greater decline in the value of cryptos, and a lot of those, the vast majority of those things disappearing. And are people losing, at this point, they've got maybe $2 to $3 trillion of value in the crypto market, most of which will just evaporate because it's total fiat, right? I mean, it's just, there's nothing there, and there's no one that you can sue when it disappears. So I don't think that we've seen the crypto crash. That may help, but the really important thing, which has been absent the silver market for at least four decades, is if you want someone to buy silver, you have to market it effectively. You know, if no one's selling silver, it's hard for people to buy silver. And the silver market right now is overrun with people who, well, you know, there's a lot of people who are charlatans and they're scammers and they're liars, or they just don't know what they're talking about. And when young investors go online and they say, hey, you know, I heard about this Wall Street silver. Let me do it. You know, when I heard about Wall Street silver last year, I guess it was late February or early March, it was people in their 30s laughing about it to me. Like, you should see this shit that people are saying about silver and you personally, Jeff, online. You know, investors, young investors and old investors, they listen to this stuff and they get turned off. And there's this disenchantment, you know, and the industry itself does a dreadful job of marketing silver. They come up with the most lamest things to say as to why you should own silver, and they just go out of their way to turn people off. So there's no effective marketing of silver apart from what CPM Group does, and we charge $160 for our yearbook. You know, there's no effective marketing of silver by the vast majority of operations. The mints that produce the silver coin don't market silver. I mean, they send out product notices and that's it. We have a few clients who buy our research or buy research from us and they send it out to their clients, and they have pretty good results because the stuff that we're producing is really substantive and it speaks truth and it reads truthfully and honestly, and it's not this arm-waving, crazy, silver's going to $100, and there's going to be a currency market reset that, you know, there's a grand conspiracy of central bankers and billionaires who are going to take all of our money away. All that stuff just turns investors off, and you don't even have to be young to sit there and say, oh, God, this is garbage, you know, but that's probably the single most important problem facing getting new investors into silver.
All right, Jeff, we're wrapping it up here. Thank you very much for your time. I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. It was a pleasure putting it together, as always. And I guess the real takeaway is we might be in a boring market for at least a little while longer as everyone eyes what the Fed is going to do three meetings from now. But in the meantime, it is a good chance to dive into your portfolio and see kind of what stocks work best for when a rebound does happen here. Jeff, thank you as always for your time. Everybody, thanks for listening in on the weekend show. As always, you can keep in touch with Chad and I through email, fleck@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. Everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.